from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, British Prime Minister Theresa May warned members of Parliament not to delay Brexit negotiations between the UK and EU.
The United Kingdom is leaving the European Union, and my job is to get the right deal for Britain as we do.
Coming up on Forum, we'll talk to British author and journalist Sebastian Mallaby about the future of the global economy in light of Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. We'll also talk to Mallaby about his new biography of former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan. Join us after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With Britain's decision to leave the European Union and President Trump's vow to renegotiate trade deals, the world economy has entered a new period of transformation and uncertainty. Sebastian Mallaby, journalist and senior fellow for international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations, says Europe is in deep trouble. Mallaby joins us this hour to talk about the future of Europe and globalization. We'll also hear about his new book, 5 Years in the Making, all about the life and work of former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, titled The Man Who Knew. What's the lasting legacy of the Enigma, who some blame for causing the financial crisis, and who once told Congress that if I seem unduly clear to you, you must have misunderstood what I said? We welcome to the program Sebastian Mallaby.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Great to have you here. And I want to begin, actually, by making my listeners aware of a tweet which I thought had some wisdom behind it, one of your tweets where you said, actually, chill out, America. constant panic about Donald Trump undermines essentially his critics and boosts him and his base. Not every Trump outrage is outrageous. Probably a good thing to remember. I'll just bring that out here. But there is a lot of concern. There is a lot of anxiety because of all that's taken place in the first few weeks. And I want to get into the global economy and Brexit and Alan Greenspan with you. But let's talk about Trump first, because it seems like he's trying to go back to kind of a pre-global economy with American hegemony and with, you know, coal manufacturing and all of those kinds of things that, you can't go home again, many Americans would say. I would be one of them.
Well, I mean, that's right. And to be clear, I share the critique of his deglobalization aspirations. I mean, I'm somebody who is British born, came to live in the U.S., naturalized, became American, spent 18 years here. And of course, I believe in free movement across borders. I believe that it's part of, freedom for people to be able to move around. And when goods can cross borders, that tends to be better for economic growth. And you have to redistribute the gains properly, but it's still good to trade. And I think trying to unscramble the U.S. relationship, say, with Mexico, when the goods coming across the border from Mexico are 40% American made in the components, is just going to be a nightmare.
Well, in fact, you at one point, I believe, called Turkey the new Mexico. Beginning of a currency crisis. Don't want to necessarily get into Turkey and Erdogan here, but they have a terrorist problem. They have all kinds of tensions going on. And I found that quite curious and maybe even apt to call Turkey the new Mexico.
Well, what I meant by that is simply that when you have a period of rising U.S. interest rates, which I think we're going to have, and a stronger dollar, there tends to be some country in the emerging world which has borrowed a lot of money in dollars and suddenly can't afford to pay the dollars back because the dollars are going up. And in 1995, the crisis was in Mexico. In 1982, if you go way back, the crisis began in Mexico. But this time, it's really Turkey that's been looking the most vulnerable as dollar-denominated borrowings are suddenly impossible for it to pay back.
The most powerful man in America, some used to say, was Alan Greenspan. Now they say it's Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, we'll get to Alan Greenspan, but Steve Bannon has a decidedly nationalistic view, and a view which has come across to us as one about changing the nature, the whole configuration of the world, and particularly with respect to globalization. What kind of impact does he have on Brexit?
Well, I mean, Brexit in Britain was obviously voted upon back in June of last year, way before Bannon came on the scene. And I think it's sort of chugging along on its own momentum towards the UK indeed.
But forgive me, he talks about a world tea party now, and I think he's including that.
Well, okay, so you've got Bannon seeking to sweep the British example into a kind of global theory of rising nationalism and deglobalization. Yeah. So in that sense, I think Brexit is influencing Bannon more than Bannon is influencing Brexit.
And you've said that Brexit particularly is uncertain. That's kind of the key word. But there's a sense that it's still spreading, and it's actually doing pretty well where consumers are concerned. That's the opposite of what was supposed to occur.
Yeah, it has been a surprise. So when people voted to get out of the EU in Britain, it essentially meant you were going to break up the relationship with the trading partner to which you export fully 43% of your exports. I mean, that's what Britain does with Europe. And to walk away from that market is going to have big economic consequences. And you'd have thought that the British consumer, seeing this big crack-up coming down the road, would feel very nervous and therefore stop spending, because when you're worried about the future, typically the rational thing to do is to save. But what's interesting is that's not what people have done. They've actually gone out and carried on spending, and they've kind of zoned out the politics. I think that's a sort of insight into the behavior of people in the world. You know, politics is complicated. It's a bunch of people arguing and yelling at each other, and often regular people just zone it out.
And you have Theresa May now talking about the phased process of implementation to avoid the cliff's edge.
Well, she would like that, but there's absolutely no clarity that the other 27 members of the European Union will play ball. I mean, they may not want to give her the phased process that she would like, because they're worried that it would become the permanent deal. So we simply don't know what's going to happen to Britain in the next 2-3 years. And whatever the Prime Minister says is kind of irrelevant, in the sense that she's got to negotiate that deal with the other 27 countries. It's kind of like, you know, Donald Trump saying, you know, I want Mexico to pay for the wall. Well, you know, Mexico has to be somehow made to do that, and it's not clear that he's got the tools.
What about the tools of trade? I mean, let's talk about Donald Trump and trade for a moment, because there is concern that's been voiced by you and others who are pretty knowledgeable and perceptive about the way these things unfold, about the possibility of a serious trade war with China.
Yes, I do worry about that a lot. I worry about it in the sense that the Chinese leadership right now is not in the mode of compromising, for two reasons. One is that I think the Chinese economy is more fragile than it appears. They've been propping up growth at the politically acceptable 6.5% last year. But to do that, they've had to allow debt to grow very, very quickly. And a lot of rich Chinese people, Chinese companies, feel nervous about this debt bubble and that it's going to blow up and people are going to lose money. So they're trying to get their money out of the country. And the only reason that hasn't made the country, the currency crash, is that very aggressive political exchange controls have been slapped on to force people to keep money in the country. That is an unstable cocktail. And you put on top of that the fact that Xi Jinping is trying to consolidate his leadership ahead of the September party meeting. I don't think he wants to lose face. So I think if Donald Trump does something that he doesn't like, he will, for nationalism reasons and for political reasons, for his own base, he'll need to hit back.
Now, President Trump has been counterpunching, is his word, China quite a bit, as opposed to Russia, of course, and Putin, whom he seems to be sidling up to. We're talking to Sebastian Malaby, who is Paul A. Volcker, Senior Fellow for International Economics with the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, also author of The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. Sea change on trade with Brexit, though, hasn't there been?
Well, for Britain, you know, this is an incredible experiment in deglobalization. You know, having joined the European Union in 1973 and having integrated the UK economy very deeply with the rest of Europe, to get out is radical. I mean, you know, more than half the workers in London are foreign born. It's a very, very globalized place. When I moved back to London a couple of years ago, I had an affiliation with the London School of Economics, and I went to have a drink with my friends from this new department, about 25 people. There was only one British-born person there, and that was me, and I'm now American.
But, you know, one of the things, I was looking at this economic forum that you had with the Council on Foreign Relations, and a couple of things stood out for me. One, 80% loss of jobs from not trade, automation.
Absolutely. So if you go after trade and you try to put up barriers, it's not like you're suddenly going to recapture all those manufacturing jobs that have been lost, because 80% of those losses are to do with automation. You can see that by looking at the total manufacturing output in the US, which has not gone down, and then looking at the jobs, which have gone down a lot. So it's not that we cease to produce stuff in the US, it's that machines are doing it instead of people.
And you talk about manufacturing in the US also. What came out of that conference was actually the word populism was used, more spent on farmers in decline than manufacturers. It's kind of strange wrinkle to populism.
I think it is worth remembering that, you know, in the post-Second World War period, there's huge amounts of resources that have been devoted to looking after farmers who are in the declining sector. So as farming was declining and machines and tractors and all that allowed you to produce way more food with fewer actual farmers, and farm prices were falling because of rising output, the sort of hit to the farmers was reduced by tax subsidies, by trade protection, by a whole host of measures. And that's true in the US, that's true in the UK, it's massively true in Japan, by the way. So all rich economies have kind of looked after the farmers as their natural position in the economy has been under fire. And we didn't do anything quite as generous towards manufacturing workers. And I think in some sense, in the Trump phenomenon, we're reaping the whirlwind of that.
Again, we're talking with journalist Sebastian Mallaby, talking about Brexit, globalization, and we'll be talking about his Alan Greenspan biography, which is called The Man Who Knew. And he's Paul A. Volcker, Senior Fellow for International Economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. And let me invite you to call now. May want to talk indeed about globalization, Brexit, and if that's on your mind or if you have questions about it or about Alan Greenspan, then feel free to join the program. You can do that at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. You can call us now and let us know what your thoughts are about anything we've been discussing and join the conversation. You can also join us by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. We do welcome your involvement. And let's talk a little bit about Alan Greenspan, the man who knew. Title.
Yes, so I picked that title because as I did this research over 5 years, I discovered the amazing extent to which he understood financial fragility. So people think sometimes that we had a crisis in 2008 and the global financial system blew up because some naive believer in the self-policing efficiency of markets was in control and that he just didn't get it. That is not true about Alan Greenspan. I mean, I've read the PhD thesis he did in his 30s. I've read all his letters to his clients when he was a consultant on Wall Street, and I've gone through the whole record. And he was obsessed with financial instability. He was the man who knew that finance was indeed unstable.
But there's been a good deal of criticism ongoing about Greenspan. He was too concerned, especially in his later years, for example, with upsetting financial markets.
I think it's true that he overdid what was called the Greenspan put, where he would cut interest rates and intervene the moment that the markets had a big hiccup. So a good example would be that the Nasdaq tech bubble burst in March of 2000. And following that, there was very aggressive interest rate cuts, especially after 2001. And that did stabilize the economy, but it had the cost of reducing mortgage interest rates and therefore fueling the bubble in subprime real estate that came later. So I think he intervened too much with respect to bubbles, but he was not ignorant about the danger in finance. If you want a theory about why we have unstable financial markets, it's really not about understanding, it's about politics. And that, I think, is a warning for the future, because if you ask the question, has politics come to constrain technical experts more or less in Washington, D.C.? I would say clearly the technocrats are on the defense right now in Donald Trump's Washington.
He was generally given a great deal of credit for being really quite able when it came to inflation, especially inflation control, but not so much with, and I think you've maybe intimated this, limiting leverage or bubbles.
Yes. Now, that's true. He did allow an enormous increase in leverage and he did allow bubbles. Question is, why? What did he do wrong? And most people would say, you know, he should have regulated all that stuff more. And that remains, by the way, the doctrine of the central bank. The Federal Reserve System, most of its leaders still think that you address too much leverage by putting on tougher regulation. But in my careful use of, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests and other methods to get documents from inside the Fed at the time, what you see is they did try regulation more than we remember. They did try to limit subprime crazy mortgages. They did try to have banks hold more capital. They did try to limit Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in their size. So they kind of had the right instincts about limiting the leverage, but politics got in the way and they failed to do what they wanted.
Always does, doesn't it?
It does.
The way that is. We're talking to Sebastian Mallaby, and we're going to go to your calls. You can join us at 866-733-6786. That's toll-free. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. Charlie is our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted your comments on the idea that people have put forth of a basic income, a universal basic income, as a response both to automation of jobs and also just the general richer getting richer, poor getting poorer. So I know there's some experiments around the world dealing with universal basic income, and I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. It's been floated around for quite some time now. Some thoughts from you on this, Sebastian Mallaby?
Charlie, that's a great question. I certainly kind of agree with the sentiment behind the basic income. I do think that, you know, inequality is a big deal, and I wrote a lot about it as a journalist. I don't know whether the basic income is the best way to do it, in the sense that if it's a policy where everybody automatically gets this basic income, you're going to be giving a lot of money to some people who maybe don't need it, or who have decided to not work because, you know, whatever, they want to pursue something which they're choosing to pursue. They might have family money, or, you know, you can just imagine a lot of cases where scarce government resources are being funneled towards people without any conditions and irrespective of whether or not they need it. And I think there is a case for targeting actions by the government in a world of limited resources.
When you say Europe is in deep trouble, what do you mean?
Europe is in deep trouble in the sense that it has, you know, put something like 18 of the countries now into this single currency, the euro. And that currency means that you've got one set of interest rates for the whole eurozone. And it just is not the case that Italy or Greece is usefully served by the same interest rate that Germany or Holland is. And so they're all locked into this one kind of single currency club, which does not make economic sense, and they don't know how to get out.
And what about emerging markets? I mean, this is, again, something you took up in discussion with Council Foreign Relations on economics, talking specifically about Brazil and India. Where do you see them in the whole globalization that's moving forward?
Well, they've done a lot better, I think, in the last few years than they did, let's say, in the 90s, when there was enormous instability. And I think you do see here the improvements in macroeconomic management. I mean, people have figured out that you should not have, a pegged currency. You should not have zero central bank reserves. You need to build your defenses. You should not issue too much debt in dollars. You should try and issue debt in your own currency. So there are some basic lessons which emerging markets, relative to 20 years ago, have really absorbed extremely well. And that's why I think you're seeing much more stability in the last few years, despite lots of shocks that have happened. I mean, commodity prices have gone from very high a few years ago to completely collapsing. Think of energy prices. And that's the kind of shock which would normally have caused much more acute collapses in places like Brazil. But Brazil has had a problem. It's had a very deep recession, but it hasn't completely fallen apart. Even, by the way, though, it had a huge corruption scandal in the political system. And yet it's sort of coming through that stuff, I think, in a way that shows that institutional resilience has increased in emerging markets.
Again, we're talking to Sebastian Mallaby, and he's of the Council of Foreign Relations, senior fellow there for international economics, and author of The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. And there's been some speculation that things may take a course with Donald Trump as president and the Fed, which Mr. Greenspan was head of for many years, like in the 1980s.
Yes, I do think that's a danger, that we haven't had a period in which the White House has really tried to beat up the Fed. You have to go back for 25 years to when Greenspan was chairman and George H.W. Bush was in the White House. And at that time, the Bush administration did try to force the Greenspan Fed to cut interest rates. And, you know, Richard Darman, who was the budget director at the time, This is kind of a funny story, but he would go around Washington whispering, trying to discredit Greenspan. He would say, Alan Greenspan is 65 years old, calls his mother every day. Bit creepy? Does it remind you of Alfred Hitchcock's movie Psycho? So there was all this pressure on the Fed, and Greenspan was a model in how you resist that. You know, if politicians came after him and punched him on the nose, he had ways of punching them back. He had contacts in the Senate who could block stuff that the administration wanted. He had contacts in the media who would maybe write negative stories about the administration. He had contacts in the markets. And so because of this, Greenspan proved that he was not a guy you wanted to pick a fight with. And I think as Janet Yellen contemplates likely pressure from Donald Trump, she would do well to study the Greenspan playbook of how you resist.
Yeah, but he had a lot of names in his, I mean, it's like, not necessarily having things on people like J. Edgar Hoover did, but he certainly had, as you suggest, the connections.
Well, one of my friends did say to me, you know, Alan Greenspan is the J. Edgar Hoover of economics, and I think that's a kind of exaggeration. But I mean, the point about Greenspan is that he had been in Washington a very long time indeed. He got involved in the Nixon campaign in 1967, 1968. In the 70s, he would fight battles with guys like Henry Kissinger, and he would beat him. You know, they were both in the Ford administration, and I've got all the, you know, the transcripts of Kissinger's conversations with his deputies, and Kissinger would turn around and say, "Why did the New York Times just run a negative story about me saying that I was dumb?" And the deputy would say, "Well, Greenspan planted that." And Kissinger would say, "Oh, I guess so." So over a long period of time, Greenspan accumulated both contacts in Washington and political skills, including the dark arts. And I think that is what made him so successful. I mean, I started, you know, thinking I was writing a big book about the most important post-war economist in America. And it turned out I was also writing a book about a mesmerizing Machiavellian politician.
And maybe a little bit like Hitchcock after all. Let me ask you, though, quickly, because we're coming up on a break and I want to bring more of our listeners in this, but about the announcement by the Trump administration that they're going to promise to deregulate the U.S. banking industry. What do you make of that?
You know, what strikes me about this is that there are things you could fix in the Dodd-Frank post-crisis reforms, for sure. But really, reducing protections for people who have pension savings would have been very, very low on my list of things you should mess around with. I mean, I do not understand, other than the idea that, you know, there are financial lobbies who would profit from undoing that regulation, that there's no good policy reason that I can see for starting there. So I was very disappointed by that.
And taxing Mexico to build a wall?
You know, I think these sorts of measures are appalling, both because the wall, you know, won't stop people from coming in, and because it's a terrible way to treat your ally.
It's also going to be very difficult to get back past some Native American land ownership in terms of building that wall, as well as other difficulties that we could dwell on. But we're talking really about Brexit and globalization and Alan Greenspan. Biography of Alan Greenspan is out now. The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. The author is our guest, Sebastian Mallaby, and feel free to join the program again. Toll free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with journalist Sebastian Mallaby about Brexit, globalization, Alan Greenspan, and with Britain's decision to leave the European Union, and President Trump's vow to renegotiate trade deals, the world economy has entered a new period of transformation and uncertainty. And Sebastian Mallaby has certainly done a lot of spade work on that and brought a great deal to our attention along those lines. And he says Europe is in deep trouble. And we're talking about the future of Europe, globalization, and his new book about Alan Greenspan, which is called The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. We do welcome your involvement in the program. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. And I want to go right to your calls, emails, and postings on the website. But first, let's talk a little bit more about Greenspan, because he is such a fascinating figure and such an idiosyncratic and eccentric character. They say that you, the Brits, are the idiosyncratic ones, but, you know, this was, as you said, just sort of a mama's boy and Machiavellian and this strange combination of things. And I thought maybe we could talk a bit about his rise, which you take up in the biography. A lot of it was coincidental.
Yeah, I mean, for example, he was married twice, so he's not against marriage. You know, his first marriage was when he was about 26, 27, and then he was single until he was 71, right? But that's a different story. But
I should have mentioned he married Andrea Mitchell. I said his better half, definitely better half, and I didn't name her, the NBC correspondent.
Right, right. So he was married twice, but just, you know, single for most of his life. That was the wrinkle. But anyway, the thing about the coincidence that you're talking about is, you know, one example would be that his first and brief marriage led him to be introduced to Ayn Rand, who was the libertarian novelist, you know, author of Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. And that really got him thinking about a big libertarian worldview. You know, before that, he'd been a data geek. He'd been buried in the numbers. He wasn't really interested in politics. And Ayn Rand transformed him into an ideologue.
Wanting to be John Galt.
Exactly, wanting to be John Galt and giving speeches entitled The Economics of a Free Society in Ayn Rand's name and saying things like the creation of the Federal Reserve was an historic disaster. I mean, you couldn't make it up. The guy who embodied the Fed later on believed there shouldn't be a Fed because, like Ayn Rand at the time, Greenspan believed in the gold standard.
We have a lot of cabinet appointments now by President Trump of people who don't believe, you know, Rick Perry didn't believe in the Department of Energy. He's heading up the Department of Energy. Alan Greenspan and Watergate. Can you just, and then we'll go to our callers and listeners.
Well, there is this extraordinary story where, you know, Nixon in 1971 wanted to force the Fed to cut interest rates so that he could be reelected in 72. And the way he did this, and this is a bit of a warning to Janet Yellen about how the Fed can be undermined, is that Nixon got together with some of his advisors, including people who went to jail later for Watergate, like Chuck Colson, and they invented a story to embarrass the Fed chairman. They put it out in public, and once they'd ruined his reputation with his story, they got a friend of the Fed chairman to go see him to talk him into a different policy, and that friend was Alan Greenspan. So Greenspan was sort of complicit in a plot to bully the Fed back in the 70s, and then ironically later became the person who established modern Fed independence by resisting political bullying in the Bush administration in the early 1990s.
You don't see any of his successors playing those kind of political roles.
No, I think it's a fun. I think there's basically it's an interesting
Bernanke,
thing.
Bernanke, Yellen, I mean, they're not really that involved in politics.
Well, I think there's a debate about experts and how do experts and technocrats defend themselves in Washington, D.C. And one view would be you just ignore politics, you go inside your ivory tower and you say, I'm just going to do my technocratic thing. Another view is, no, that doesn't work because the politicians come after you. So you got to be willing to wield power. You got to understand power and be ready to use it. And that was the Greenspan model. He'd been tutored by Nixon in the dark arts of politics. And when the first Bush administration came after him, he used those dark arts to push back. And I think that proved very successful.
We'll bring our callers on. Let me begin, Mike, with you. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'm a longtime listener and appreciate all the work that you and your colleagues do on the program.
Thank you.
I'm happy to ask your guest if he could just elaborate a little bit on the predicament he kind of called out in the EU, where you have some weaker sub-economies like Greece and Italy and some more powerful ones. But I'm thinking, isn't that just like the United States, where we have some states that contribute a lot more to GDP and could be very considered very strong economic engines, combined with, you know, states that are, you know, less productive? Maybe you could just elaborate on why it's such a problem to have these, you know, less contributing countries in the EU.
Sure. So that's a great question. And it's true that the United States has a currency union. Everybody uses the dollar and there's big economic variations between Arkansas and California or whatever. So you're absolutely right. But the difference is that within the United States, two things act as stabilizers for the fact that you've got a single currency. The first thing is that people are more mobile. You can move from Appalachia to California. And you can move in Europe, of course. That is part of the deal. There's freedom of movement. But, you know, Italians speak Italian and Germans speak German. And there are barriers to movement, I think, more than in the U.S.
People from Arkansas sometimes speak their own language.
The other thing is very important is if you look at the federal budget in the United States, it's really quite big. I mean, I think it's 26%, 27% of U.S. GDP. And in that budget, there's a huge amount of redistribution geographically that goes on. So taxes are raised from the rich states and then money is funneled through the budget into the poorer states. And in Europe, by contrast, the central Brussels budget is something more like about 1% of Eurozone or European Union GDP. And so redistribution within the European Union or in the currency zone is almost nothing. And that removes a stabilizing force.
Let me thank the caller and go to a couple comments. A listener writes, countries that allow foreign ownership of real estate have the highest value currencies. That's because investment creates jobs. Even a rich guy in a mansion has to hire servants. We have to recognize that laws against foreign ownership of land are just another form of xenophobia and represent the principal economic difference between Western countries and the countries that they run trade deficits with. Another comment from Matt, who says, characterizing the withdrawal from trade agreements as both anti-trade and nationalistic misses the mark. Many on the left have become interested in local resiliency and supporting American-made products. Defining these reactions as nationalistic creates an imprecise connotation of being right-wing. Sebastian Mallaby.
So let's take the second one first. It's true that there is a kind of localization preference amongst some people, and perhaps that's more of a left-wing thing. But I think there's a fundamental difference between consumers freely choosing that they would like to eat food that's been grown within a 50-mile radius of where they live or whatever is their choice, and the government intervening and sort of forcing those choices by imposing tariffs and other barriers. I think it's, you know, in one case it's freedom, in the other case it's the opposite. So I think there is a bit of a difference there. On the real estate point, I think it's broader than that. A country like the United States that has assets that other people would like to hold as a store of value, and that could just be U.S. Treasury bills or it could be U.S. real estate. Those countries are going to attract inflows of capital from people seeking to park their money somewhere safe. That will push up the dollar, and that will mean that there is a structural current account deficit, a structural trade deficit between the U.S. and the rest of the world. And that is a very important message because it's one that President Trump appears to have missed. He looks at the world, he sees that the U.S. has a current account deficit, and he says, therefore, it must be unfair. Well, it's not that. You know, if you have the reserve currency, you will run a trade deficit. And you can be as protectionist as you like. You can tear up the World Trade Organization. You can build a wall with Mexico. There will still be a trade deficit if the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency.
And more of your calls. Hugh joins us next. Hugh, you're on.
Hi. I want to ask your guest about two subjects. The first is China, which has been knocking off IP and entire supply chains, not just in the U.S., but also in Africa and other third world countries. So what moderate steps can be done to actually get fair trade with China? And then my second question is what to do with all the unemployed workers, whether it's automation or trade. It's not good for their families or for democracy.
So on dealing with China, I think we need to remember that China's trade surplus, or more accurately, the current account surplus, was around 10% of Chinese GDP about 10 years ago. And it's come down to something like 2.5%. So there's been progress there. And you're right about intellectual property. I'm sure that it's true that China does rip off some stuff, force licensing deals that effectively takes away other people's intellectual property. But you can deal with that through the proper channels. You know, there are ways within the World Trade Organization that you can bring disputes or through other legal mechanisms. It's not a good idea, I think, to jeopardize the entire trading relationship and, frankly, to risk a serious diplomatic confrontation, you know, over something which is getting better anyway, and which is a significant issue, but you don't want to, you know, go too far in so that your sanctions are worse than the disease that you're trying to cure.
Let me thank you for the call. We're going to go to your comments here and some questions. And Sebastian Mallaby, I want to remind you, is our guest. He's the author of The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. How long were you with The Economist, by the way? I used to read you in The Economist.
I was with The Economist for almost 13 years.
Yeah. A couple questions about Greenspan, but here's Joseph who asks, world trade as a percentage of global GDP has been decreasing. Doesn't this suggest that countries are becoming more economically autonomous? Trade in the U.S. amounts to only about 10% of U.S. GDP. Isn't this a good thing?
It's true that trade had been growing very quickly as a share of global GDP, and then it sort of leveled off. And part of that leveling off is weird measurement things, like, for example, you know, if the price of oil collapses and oil is traded a lot and oil is priced in dollars, then just the sheer fact that the oil is cheaper means that it looks like you're trading less as a share of global GDP. It's not that actually the barrels are going down, but the price of them is going down. And so it shows up as a decline. But I think there's still some truth in the idea that global trade has stopped growing quite as quickly as it was before. I think to some extent, supply chains, which were massively cross-border, were overstretched, and companies started to realize that having more of your production locally meant that you were more resilient in the face of some kind of shipping interruption or whatever. But I think all of that is fine. One shouldn't obsess about the level of trade in GDP too much. What matters is that if companies want to move stuff across borders, if consumers want to buy stuff from other countries, then they should be allowed to, because they're making free choices that are probably in their own interest and are actually maximizing their prosperity. I don't think one should overdo that statistic.
Well, there is a sense that GDP growth being down is something that's going to last.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting debate. And my own view is that the pessimists who say productivity is kind of permanently depressed, productivity gains, I don't think there's conclusive evidence for that at all, because the fact is economists have a hard time predicting spurts in productivity growth. They've never predicted them. And productivity has periods like in the late 1990s of growing rather quickly, and productivity has periods like in the recent times of growing rather slowly. But we don't really know that we're in some permanent trough.
Well, whenever I hear economists predicting, I must confess that's a dismal science. If it's a science at all. Let me go to another caller and remind you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786 with Sebastian Mallaby. Paul, next on. Good morning, Paul.
Hi. Good morning, Michael. Thank you for the show. I'm a Signal Society member, so I love KQED and NPR. My question here is, it was touched on earlier about manufacturing jobs going overseas, but and the minimum income ideas. But we have some things on the horizon where we're going to get rid of jobs a lot more than just manufacturing. We have rideshare, which is getting rid of taxi cab drivers. We have Watson being successful at emulating lawyers at a higher rate than human lawyers do. We are going to eliminate a huge chunk of jobs, not just at the bottom, but in the middle, where we really won't have enough available jobs to support the economy and society in a couple of decades if we go down the track. It looks like we're going down. And how does the society cope with that tipping point?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a serious question, very well put. I mean, I think one illustration of this is that there are a lot of states where the single greatest, you know, biggest category of employment is driving vehicles, you know, trucking, not just taxis, but all sorts of transportation. And if we get self-driving vehicles, which I believe we will have in the next decade or whatever it is, those jobs are going to go away. And that's a very serious public policy issue. And I think something proactively needs to be done to try to retrain drivers as much as possible. And where people, you know, don't want the retraining, maybe, you know, income support is the answer. I wouldn't go quite as far as this basic income blanket thing for everybody, because I think then you're spending a lot of money and not every case you spend it on is the most needy one. I would rather conserve the resources and target it at, you know, people in the trucking sector, for example.
Let me thank the caller and go to another email from James, who wants to know about Russia. I want your thoughts, Sebastian Mallaby, about, well, he says, can you please comment on Russia's actions, influence, and goals for Western Europe? And we may be asking for prognosticating here or predicting, but just get your take on something that's always been on my mind, and that is the seeming goodwill, some call it a reset, from President Trump toward Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. It seems logical in many ways that they may have common financial interests. They're both billionaires. Trump's son once said, you know, we have more – back in 2008, but he said we have more disproportionate number of investments in Russia. We can't see Trump's tax return, so we don't know where his investments are. But doesn't that seem to be logical?
You know, I think the thing with the Trump-Russia connection in terms of business may have been that a lot of Russians are high-end purchasers of real estate outside Russia because they're scared of staying in there. So they're buying condos and so forth from the Trump businesses.
But I'll bet there's also investment in Russian oil and gas resources. And I mean, who knows? Like I said, we really
could be,
don't know.
Could be. I mean, I think on the geopolitics of this, look, Russia is an autocratic and scary country. I mean, it's run by somebody who used to be a secret police KGB guy. He's shown a willingness to use force abroad in violation of international norms, as he's done in Ukraine. He's willing to use cyber methods to intervene in the media and intervene in domestic politics in the West, including in the United States before the election. This is all pretty sinister stuff, and I think we need to be clear-eyed about the kind of leader that Vladimir Putin is. So I'm concerned about what President Trump has been saying. I hope he comes to his senses on this. I think there's one grain of plausibility, though, that we ought to keep in mind at the same time, to be fair, which is that with respect to the disastrous humanitarian situation in Syria, there was a problem there in the Obama administration of saying that there were red lines, then not enforcing them, saying that you were, you know, had various foreign policy objectives in terms of the Syria situation, but then not doing anything and allowing a vacuum to emerge in which Russia filled. And you have to choose. You're either going to stand up to Russia, challenge it, and assert U.S. power in a vigorous fashion, which probably includes more willingness to use military force. Or if you're not going to do that, you're going to let Russia be the big kid on the block in places like Syria. You should be honest about that.
And places like Crimea and Ukraine too.
Yeah. So I think you start, you have to have a clarification of where the U.S. is willing to put military resources and where it isn't.
Even Mitch McConnell, because he's a Republican leader, was concerned about the moral equivalency. We heard from President Trump the other day in some testimony he gave where he said, well, it was actually not testimony, it was being interviewed by Bill O'Reilly, and he said, well, you know, after Putin was called a thug and a killer, we've had our killers too, you know, as if the United States somehow liked Putin.
And it's not just Mitch McConnell. I mean, several leaders in the Senate, you know, John McCain being an obvious example, are going to be very unhappy with this view of Putin. And this could be, you know, quite a significant political factor in terms of Trump's ability to get on with the Congress, ability to get stuff through the Congress. If he alienates them by taking this position on Russia, it's going to cost him politically across a bunch of issues.
I think you're absolutely right. I also think it could be very perilous for him to continue to push this some call bromance, or, you know, I mean, the idea that we have to get along with Russia much better, that he likes Putin and Putin likes him, and therefore we can do something about ISIS with Russia together, because, you know, the idea of saving money, for example, from cutting back on NATO can really change the whole geopolitics as we have come to understand it. If Trump starts pulling away from NATO, which seemed to be what he was saying in the campaign, we've got a whole different ballgame.
Right now in Europe, we have a year in which there are going to be elections in France, elections in the Netherlands, elections in Germany.
Yeah.
And it's quite likely that you know, stuff will come out about Putin intervening in those elections. And I don't think Trump wants to be the guy who's, you know, having a bromance with the person who's meddling in Western democracy.
Let me actually get to some of these Greenspan questions. Here's Jack, who says, I recall after the 2007 financial collapse, Greenspan publicly admitted that he had gotten it wrong for 30 years. Was this just a ploy to stave off the question of, if you knew, why did you do nothing?
That's a great question, because I think it was a bit of a misleading answer that Greenspan gave to that. You know, he famously said in Congress, I found a flaw. I found a flaw in my ideology. And he seemed to be implying that, you know, his basic understanding of finance, and in particular of banks' willingness to take the necessary steps to protect their balance sheets so they wouldn't blow up, that he'd just gotten this completely wrong. Now, he didn't really mean that. And if he did, you know, he was forgetting his own record because, I mean, I talked to Greenspan a long, long time. You know, I lost count after 70 hours of interviewing him. For me, it was research, and for him, it was therapy. But you know, I know him well enough to know that he had lived through every single financial crisis of the modern era, you know, starting with Penn Central Railroad blowing up in 1970, you know, Continental Illinois Bank, the first too big to fail in 1984, the stock market crashes in 87, savings and loans crash in the early 1990s, commercial real estate bust, long-term capital management blows up in 1998, NASDAQ blows up. He absolutely knew that finance was not stable. So whatever he said about a flaw, that's a bit of a digression.
Again, if you've just joined us, we've been talking with Sebastian Mallaby, who, again, is the author of The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. He's now a senior fellow for international economics with the Council of Foreign Relations. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll bring another caller in. We'll go to Cupertino and welcome Vijay. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. So I guess my real question here is, right, I mean, free trade is a beautiful thing, right? When it works on a microeconomic perspective, people trade and buy goods from their interests. There's no frictional interest, and clearly it's the best model out there. But what have you observed when you look at any of the macroeconomic issues, when people are bringing ideology and Greenspan included with being too big to fail versus companies' interests and how they're supporting different areas? It clearly doesn't seem to work as well. So I'm not sure why Trump is taking a perspective of, look, it doesn't really working for U.S. and the interests for the population. Why exactly is that a erroneous position? Clearly, there are things which work and don't, but there are a lot of things which don't seem to have worked for the U.S. interests. So why is there a particular problem there?
Thank you, Vijay. Sebastian Mallaby.
You know, Trump said he wanted to make America great again, but actually the U.S. economy was pretty great already in many ways. I mean, you know, we are now in the midst of, I think, the third longest economic expansion since the Second World War. Unemployment is below 5%. Relative to the Europeans or the Japanese, we have, you know, far better prospects. There are certainly issues to do with inequality. And there are big issues to do with automation and the displacement of workers from jobs like transport, as we've been discussing. And so I think you should focus the inquiry on things like the displacement of workers in certain sectors because of technology. And pointing the finger at other stuff like trade or having a just generalized sense that, hey, you know, America's not working, it's a nightmare, we've got to fix it. That's just way too unspecific. You need to, in order to make progress in the world, you need to diagnose the real problem much more accurately than that.
Well, speaking, and let me thank the caller of technology replacing jobs. I'm looking at an email here from Brian who says, I recently visited a thriving middle-class village in Bavaria with lots of good jobs. When I asked what the local factory made, a local sheepishly told me, robots that replace American factory workers. Any chance the USA can get into the robot building business?
Well, Germany is famously good at making machine tools and robots. But I think the U.S. isn't too bad at it either. I mean, there's a lot of experimentation right here in California.
Right in Silicon Valley, in fact.
Indeed,
yeah.
With robotics. And when it comes to artificial intelligence, sort of thinking machines, then the U.S. surely is right at the forefront. So I don't think we should be too scared of those Bavarians.
Another question about Alan Greenspan. Paul wants to know, what was Alan Greenspan's role in the savings and loan crisis? Wasn't he the attorney for the criminally guilty bankers? And was his elevation to the Fed somehow an old boys club payback for his role in defending the banking community's worst crooks?
No, Alan Greenspan was not an attorney. What is true, though, is that he wrote a letter stupidly vouching for a particular savings and loan that then later blew up. So he should not have vouched for that savings and loan. I think, frankly, he did it because he had a consulting fee, not as a lawyer, but as an economist. And he wrote a letter without doing enough actual work on figuring out if this company that was paying him was any good or not. So that was a clear mistake, which I identify in my biography of him as a clear mistake. but I don't think he was elevated to the Fed because of that. And I think, you know, although that was a big error, it was not something that was significant enough to be the basis of judging his whole career.
And here's John. John, thank you for waiting. Join us, please.
Thank you. I just had a quick question. You were talking about foreign currency reserves and the fact that the United States has is the reserve currency, fiat currency for the world. I was wondering, I've heard like over the years that there's been rumors of like Russia and China basically getting together and trying to come up with their own type of currency or some type of, in other words, as a counterbalance or another fiat or reserve currency instead of the U.S. dollar as a way of kind of undermining or at least improving their status in the world.
Yeah, thanks, John, for that. We've actually talked about that on forum. It doesn't seem to be going with much mobility behind it, does it, Sebastian?
No, I agree, Michael. I mean, I think after the 2008 crisis, a lot of foreign governments that owned, let's say, Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac bonds got frightened and said, hey, we thought the dollar was stable. We thought we could save our money here and not worry about it. And now these guys have gone bankrupt. You know, we need to create our own reserve currency so we don't have to depend on these Americans who are just unreliable. So that was the sentiment, you know, 9 years ago. But really, as Michael Krasny has just said, there's been remarkably little progress in effectuating that change. The dollar is still massively dominant.
We will leave it there. We've come to the end of the hour. So good to have had you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Sebastian Malaby. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations, a senior fellow there and author of The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. We invite your emails about programs you'd like to hear or programs that you have heard. Forum at kqed.org is where you can write us and let us know. And thank you for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.